The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Lee Haber, Wadzanal Moot, Hamilton Kane, and Jashunda Sanders is titled The 50 Most Anticipated Books of 2022. We've made it through 2021. To bring in the new year, the Oprah Daily Books team has scoured the literary landscape to assess what sort of year we bibliophiles should expect in 2022. This past year was an undeniable bust in multiple ways, but it was a boom for those of us whose deepest pleasure is curling up with a great novel, collection of stories or poems, or a masterful piece of nonfiction. Many of our best writers published exciting new works, and we saw the emergence of new talent from all over the world. So what can we look forward to in the first 5 months of 2022? New novels by such luminaries as Lan Samantha Chang, Jennifer Egan, Noah Hawley, and Hanya Yanadgihara, to name just a few of the pleasures awaiting us. Viola Davis and Molly Shannon are among those who share their compelling life stories and revelatory memoirs. And Ocean Vuong, whose On Earth We Are Briefly Gorgeous was a huge hit in 2019, has a luminous volume of poetry coming in April. Also in April, we get to peer into Alice Walker's creative process via her journals. The first few months of the year also bring us newcomers such as Leela Motley and Jessamine Chan, whose novels Night Crawling and The School for Good Mothers will plant them squarely on the literary map. And then there are two of our former O colleagues, Lee Newman and Michelle Hart, whose short story collection and novel, respectively, are guaranteed to wow. So without further ado, here is our most anticipated list of 2022, the books you will want to run out to your nearest bookstore to pick up in the first few months of the year. And by the way, we will be updating this list throughout the year. Number 1, Notes on an Execution by Dania Kukovka. The pre-pub reviews are calling this thriller by the author of Girl in Snow masterly, and we agree. The novel opens on death row as a serial killer is about to meet his fate, and then explores all the influences that combine to produce a murderer. Chilling and unexpected. Number 2, You Don't Know Us, Negroes and Other Essays by Zora Neale Hurston. This definitive gathering of essays and reflections from the writer Toni Morrison, deemed one of the greatest writers of our time, spans 35 years of Hurston's work, showcasing her great intellect, social and cultural insights, wisdom, and wit, too. Here, the iconic author of Their Eyes Were Watching God shares thoughts regarding form, Black folk expression and self-possession, and her unique philosophy on politics, voting, and racism at the intersection of race, geography, and gender, with a compelling intro by Henry Louis Gates, Jr. Number 3, South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation, by Amani Perry. The South has given America its dollar stores, the best of its cuisine and culture, and while most people don't give the South credit for this, is the place where many of the leaders of the Black Power movement were born and raised. Perry, a daughter of the South and Princeton professor, shows us dimensions of the South and its centrality to American identity that have previously gone underexamined. Number 4, Lost and Found, A Memoir by Catherine Schultz. The meaning of losing a loved one and how one finds grace in the aftermath of loss is examined here, with Schultz's attentive reporting and tender vulnerability. Writing about the impact of her father's death alongside finding the love of her life, a fellow writer, Lost and Found exemplifies the best of what memoir can do and how it can make us feel. Number 5, Ancestor Trouble, A Reckoning and a Reconciliation by Maude Newton. The best way to know and understand yourself is through the lens of the past. At least that's literary blogger and journalist Newton's theory. If our lives have been circumscribed because of the way we viewed our family, she writes, confronting our ancestors as complicated human beings rather than distant archetypes can suggest different ways of being ourselves. Her interest in genealogy and its history for this powerful debut emerged out of a 2014 Harper's Magazine story. Number 6, To Paradise by Hanya Yanagihara. Into Paradise, Yanagihara reimagines a divergent United States after the Civil War. In the aftermath, the country is divided into the North, Free States, the United Colonies, and the West. The Free States comprise a world in which same-sex marriages are the norm at the turn of the 20th century. As we read, the strangeness of this world confuses, but as the story develops, we accept and then forget as we immerse ourselves in the characters' lives. That Yanagihara turns our expectations and changes our perceptions is what makes To Paradise a masterpiece. Number 7, Wahala, a novel by Nikki May. Three Nigerian-British best friends, Simi, Ronki, and Boo, met in university through their similar backgrounds. Now in their 30s and living in London, they are at various stages of success in their careers and love lives. A fourth, the wealthy Isabel, who was a childhood friend of Simi's, arrives and disrupts their predictable lives. And here's something else to look forward to. The BBC is adapting this novel into a TV drama, adding to the growing list of shows about black female friendships. Number 8, Young Mungo by Douglas Stewart. Stewart astonished the literary world with his debut, Shuggie Bane, which won the prestigious Booker Prize. His mesmerizing, provocative new novel recasts Romeo and Juliet with two teenage boys as the leads, but the novel is also a broader social canvas. Set in Glasgow in 1992, it evokes the religious turmoil between Catholics and Protestants in Scotland's largest city, pummeled by the iron fist of Margaret Thatcher's fiscal policies, perpetuating a vicious code of behavior among working-class men. Named for Glasgow's patron saint, Mungo, an impoverished Protestant, violates all kinds of norms when he falls passionately in love with James from an affluent Catholic neighborhood. Like Kevin Barry, Ali Smith, and Colson Whitehead, Stewart invents his own language, erotic, conversational, surgically precise, with an ear and eye like none other. Number 9, Perpetual West by Misha Marin. The author of the acclaimed Sugar Run returns with a suspenseful, seductive novel that unearths the unsettling secrets in a marriage. Elena searches for her missing husband, Alex, in an odyssey that carries her from West Virginia to Mexico, probing deeper themes from fluidity of desire to the rigidity of racism to familial bonds. Marin's prose is both exacting and luxurious, a thrill ride from cover to cover. Number 10, Wise Up, A Reverent Enlightenment from a Mother Who's Been Through It, by Karen Duffy. The best-selling author of Model Patient and self-taught expert on Stoicism draws on her vast knowledge of the ancient Greeks, as well as on her own experience navigating a life-threatening neurological disease, to produce a roadmap to kindness and courage. These profound and inspiring life lessons are delivered as a series of letters to her son, and they are as erudite and as entertaining as the former MTV VJ herself. Number 11, The Invisible Kingdom, Reimagining Chronic Illness, by Megan O'Rourke. In her soon-to-be iconic opening, O'Rourke writes, "I got sick the way Hemingway says you go broke, gradually and then suddenly." For decades, she experienced hives, fatigue, brain fog, and night sweats. Laboratory tests pointed in different directions, with some specialists suggesting the root causes of her symptoms were psychological. O'Rourke heard echoes of the hysteria judgments from the Victorian and Freudian eras, spurring her anger and her quest. The Invisible Kingdom, then, is a medical detective story, dramatic and beautifully written in the manner of Rebecca Skloot's The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, with a crucial difference. Patients suffering from autoimmune disorders encounter roadblock after roadblock, frustrating detours, and inevitable cul-de-sacs. The zigzagging toward the truth stoked O'Rourke's desire to advocate for others like her. Number 12, In the Margins, On the Pleasures of Reading and Writing, by Elena Ferrante. Craft essays are all the rage, but one author soars rocket-like above an overcrowded field. In these four pitch-perfect essays, the doyenne of Italian literature pores over her toolbox, discovering that reinvention is the name of her game. My adolescent mania for realism was spent. Only a desire for truth remained, which made me reject reportorial naturalism, with its splashes of dialect, the fine writing that sugarcoats the pill, the female characters always ready to lift up their heads and win. An essential read for all aspiring writers. Number 13, The Candy House by Jennifer Egan. In this inventive, effervescent novel, Egan, winner of the 2011 Pulitzer Prize for A Visit from the Goon Squad, asks the essential zeitgeist question, WhatsApp? In 2010, Bix Booten, a black tech visionary on the cusp of middle age, embarks on a mission to sate his omnivorous curiosity and enrich his family. He devises a download that accesses each person's archive of memories, opening the door to connections undreamt of by even Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerberg. But not all is well in cyberspace. Egan plates multiple narratives and techniques to underscore the manifold ways our own desires betray us in a brave new coded world. Number 14, Trust by Hernan Diaz. A virtuoso performance by an emerging talent whose first novel, In the Distance, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the Penn Faulkner Award. Trust is four books in one, a novel within a novel, a partial manuscript, a memoir, and a diary. Together, they enlist the reader as an investigator, sorting through contradictory accounts to get to the truth of just what happened to a patrician Manhattan couple during the Roaring Twenties and the Great Depression. The disparate tensions that accrete with massive fortunes weave into a spellbinding tale that illuminates the impact of money on all of our lives. Number 15, The Books of Jacob, a novel, by Olga Tokarczuk. Was Jacob Frank, a Jew who mysteriously appeared in a Polish village in the 19th century, a charismatic messiah, a scheming grifter, a crazed shapeshifter, or all or none of the above? In her first work published since winning the Nobel Prize, Tokarczuk aims high, spinning a layered, majestic, polyphonic novel based on a real-life figure. From acolytes to skeptics, she immerses us in lives both foreign and familiar, tracing the cult of Frank across a Europe and an Ottoman Empire on the brink of change. A golden age of historical fiction is upon us. Tokarczuk links arms with Hilary Mantel and Colson Whitehead, connecting our own perilous moment with the past. Number 16, Thank You, Mr. Nixon, Stories by Gish Jin. A Chinese girl in heaven writes a poison pen letter to a disgraced president in hell. A law school simmers with rivalries among immigrants. A painter pursues an obsession with the artist Mark Rothko. Welcome back to the singular world of Gish Jin's dazzling sardonic fiction. In her first collection in over 20 years, these linked stories probe the fractures in our divided country while grappling with the long tale of China's cultural revolution, skewering sacred cows, a triumph of humor and sorrow. Number 17, Fiona and Jane by Jean Chen Ho. This debut collection navigates the intimate contours of female friendship through the eponymous women Fiona and Jane, who grow up together in LA and drift apart when Fiona moves to New York. Eventually, like the best of friendships, the women find their way back to one another in these stories that alternate points of view. Excavate the push and pull of home and follow them throughout their 20s and 30s. Number 18, Either Or by Elif Batuman. It's the fall of 1996, and Harvard sophomore Selin puzzles over last summer's adventures in Hungary. The tug of attraction, the allure of canonical literature, and the what-just-happened mysteries of youth. The pencil line between fantasy and reality blurs as she decides to go back through the looking glass in search of herself. Batuman, a Pulitzer Prize finalist and New Yorker writer, brings delicious detail and light irony to her heroine's quest. Something about the name Proust sounded fussy and made me worry that he wouldn't have liked me, Selin opines. All I really knew about him was that he wrote wonderfully about childhood and about the French countryside. Number 19, The School for Good Mothers, a novel by Jessamine Chan. Frida Lou has finally found a job in Philly while also trying to share custody of her toddler, Harriet, with her estranged husband, Gust, when she makes a life-changing mistake. She leaves Harriet alone for hours to get in some work at the office. When the police find the unattended child, Kafkaesque events begin to unfold in this intense, unputdownable debut that will doubtless spark conversation about what makes a good or bad mother. Number 20, Pure Color by Sheila Hetty. Hetty's latest is an ambitious fable centered on the three kinds of people God has created: birds, fish, and bears, each with different traits. The world in which main characters Annie, a fish, Mira, a bird, and Mira's father, a bear, live is one Gott isn't happy with. He's determined to write a second draft to get it right. Love across species, reincarnation, in Mira's case, into a leaf, the possible end of life as we know it, these are some of the themes on the table in Hetty's bold philosophical tale. Number 21, Vladimir, a novel by Julia May Jonas. The unnamed narrator of playwright Jonas's debut novel has been in an open marriage with the chair of the English department at her college for many years when the Me Too accusations begin to mount, prompting the astute, sardonic narrator not only to go on the defense, but to begin to reveal some provocative desires of her own. Number 22, French Braid by Anne Tyler. In her 24th book, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author observes the Garretts from their first and last family vacation in the 1950s through the present day, examining the challenges and joys of our daily intimacies with those closest to us. Number 23, Time is a Mother by Ocean Vuong. In the acclaimed poet's first collection since the stunning On Earth Were Briefly Gorgeous, Vuong returns to familiar themes of longing, grief, and survival. Among the most haunting in the collection is a poem that lists items ordered from Amazon leading up to the death of his mother from cancer. The last line, one pair of woolen socks, a singular reminder that we come here alone and we die alone, regardless of whether time nurtures us or not. Number 24, Finding Me, a Memoir by Viola Davis. The first Black actor in history to achieve the Triple Crown of Acting, with an Oscar, an Emmy, and two Tony Awards, Davis charts her astonishing journey as the fifth of six children born to a violent father who worked as a horse trainer and a mother who worked as a maid and a factory worker. Finding Me follows Davis from an impoverished childhood in a one-room shack in South Carolina to her well-deserved stardom. Number 25, Hello Molly, a Memoir by Molly Shannon. A car accident that led to the death of her mother, her sister, and her cousin when SNL actress Molly Shannon was 4 years old set her up with a kind of courage and ability to forge ahead despite adversity, as she chronicles in this redemptive tell-all written with Sean Wilsey. From a childhood shaped by her tender relationship with her grieving father to a star-studded future as a cast member on SNL and beyond, Hello Molly offers insights into the behind-the-scenes world of a fantastic performer. Number 26, Shine Bright, A Personal History of Black Women in Pop by Danielle Smith. A prominent pioneering American culture critic, Smith here blends her unique in-depth reporting style with personal testimony to document the important stories of well-known figures like Whitney Houston and Aretha Franklin, alongside lesser-known influences on popular music like the poet Phyllis Wheatley, who sang her poems, and the singer Denise Williams. Number 27, Easy Beauty, a Memoir by Chloe Cooper Jones. I am in a bar in Brooklyn listening to two men, my friends, discuss whether my life is worth living, is the opening line in this exquisite memoir. Here, Pulitzer finalist Jones reflects on our standards of beauty from the perspective of a disabled woman, whose rare congenital condition affects her stature and gait and leaves her in constant pain. But it's ultimately motherhood that liberates her and prompts her to re-examine the limitations she has accepted as givens. Number 28, True Biz, a Novel by Sarah Novick. As a follow-up to her piercing debut, Girl at War, Novick taps her own experiences as a hearing-impaired writer. Set at the River Valley School for the Deaf, a boarding institution, True Biz tracks the desires and despair of teenagers who feel segregated and patronized by parents and physicians when all they crave is to be treated like normal students, getting through chemistry, tossing back an occasional beer, and hooking up. Novick strips away the platitudes associated with disability while weaving in images and idioms from American Sign Language. The title alludes to ASL's definition of real talk. Her deft, textured prose reveals the lush interior landscapes of her characters. Number 29, Moon Witch, Spider King, The Dark Star Trilogy by Marlon James. From Anthony Doerr's Cloud Cuckoo Land to Hanya Yanagihara's To Paradise, World building is a literary technique du jour, but few authors have had the commercial success of Marlon James, whose Black Leopard Red Wolf blew up bestseller lists from coast to coast. His epic second installment in the Dark Star trilogy, billed as an African Game of Thrones, turned on the foibles of Sogolon, a witch-come-player in the royal court of James' supernova imagination. His ambition and storytelling prowess are off the charts. Number 30, The Beauty of Dusk, on Vision, Lost, and Found by Frank Bruni. Bruni's quietly affecting, illuminating memoir chronicles his experience becoming partially blind following an ocular stroke in 2017, and contemplates the strong possibility that he will lose his eyesight entirely. With compassion and grace, Bruni guides us along a literal pilgrimage between light and darkness, a tender meld of science reporting and philosophical investigation. Perhaps best of all, he falls in love. His companion, a 50-pound dog with thick feathered fur, splashes of white so perfectly and symmetrically placed that a painter might well have applied them. Number 31, Nobody Gets Out Alive, Stories by Lee Newman. From the winner of a National Magazine Award comes an austere-winning atmospheric collection that broods on desperate lives amid Alaska's shiny flotsam of airplanes and speedboats and snow machines. Newman navigates the emotional fissures in her characters, a distraught woman willing to drive thousands of miles from an abusive marriage, a wife caught in an affair, her face a blur of panic. But the 49th state is the real star, from oil-rich Anchorage to the solace of wilderness, landscape is destiny. Number 32, Love Marriage, a Novel, by Monica Ali. In her fiercely imagined new novel, set in present-day London, the author of the lauded Brick Lane peels away the illusions we conjure when our core relationships are threatened. Yasmin, daughter of a proper, conservative, striving Muslim clan, is engaged to Joe, who hails from an affluent, progressive, narcissistic tribe. As the families attempt a peaceful merger, a crisis looms. Joe's mother once posed nude in a photograph as a kind of feminist statement. Cultural clashes, political satire, Oedipal conflicts, elegant prose, they're all here in this romp of a book. Number 33, This Time Tomorrow, a Novel, by Emma Straub. Time travel is a popular trope in fiction, and Straub deploys it brilliantly in her effervescent new novel. Alice, a New Yorker on the cusp of her 40th birthday, frets about her ailing father, until she wakes up one morning and the years have rewound to 1996. Teenage Dallas rekindles bonds with her youthful, vigorous father and sifts through disquieting feelings about her own shortcomings. Her father's room was as Spartan as Alice's room was messy. His full-size bed was always made, and the stack of books on his bedside table was the only thing not put away. There wasn't so much as a sock on the floor. Straub is an expert chronicler of social mores and the inner lives of her mostly bourgeois characters, and here she delivers a surefire bestseller. Number 34, All the Lovers in the Night by Miko Kawakami. From the celebrated author of Breasts and Eggs and Heaven comes her most accomplished novel yet. Kawakami's tale dissects the ennui of Yoko, a 30-ish copyeditor and something of a social misfit. Face down on the mattress, I pulled the covers over my head and squeezed my eyes shut, she says. Waiting for the things swirling in my throat to pass, the breath dampening my cheeks and eyelids infinitely hot and painful. Once Fuyoko resolves to transform herself, she sets into motion a chain of events that disturb the narrative in devious, electrifying ways. A contemporary Japanese master continues her meteoric rise into our literary firmament. Number 35, Very Cold People, a Novel by Sarah Manguso. My parents didn't belong in Waitsfield, but they moved there anyway. So opens Manguso's crystalline, mordant first novel about who belongs and who doesn't in a declining Massachusetts town as fortunes and status ebb and displace the WASP gentry. Ruthie, the protagonist, has never felt at home in her hometown and often wonders why. Like other New England communities, Waitsfield hides its secrets well until they erupt with a vengeance. Manguso puts her own indelible stamp on the literary terrain of John Cheever and Susan Minot, daring to brush against the third rail of class. Number 36, The Trouble with Happiness and Other Stories by Tove Ditlevsen. With the publication of her autobiographical The Copenhagen Trilogy, Ditlevsen, 1917 to 1978, garnered broad belated recognition as a Danish literary titan. First published over 5 decades ago, these terse, unnerving stories peer into the fragility of relationships and the casual epiphanies that gut her characters, among them a newlywed whose yearning for a silk umbrella forces a marital reckoning, a drill sergeant of a mother, and a young woman contemplating an abortion. Not until she was down on the street where people brushed into her impatiently on their way home for dinner did she feel like herself again, her horrified soul reeling for support like a drunkard. Something Bent had once said occurred to her. It's not our words that reveal our character, it's the deeds we undertake, regardless of their logic. A pain she had never felt before was burrowing and burning inside her. Number 37, Memphis, by Tara M. Stringfellow. This poetic, multi-generational story is set in the ancestral Memphis home. A mother and her daughters flee to escape their father's violence. Spanning 70 years and told through a variety of voices, this powerful debut novel encompasses race, class, and the legacy of trauma. Number 38, Gathering Blossoms Under Fire, The Journals of Alice Walker. Alice Walker's journals, edited by Valerie Boyd, illuminate the mind and heart of the iconic Pulitzer Prize-winning author who published The Color Purple 40 years ago. To commemorate that anniversary, we are granted entry into Walker's most intimate thoughts and into the creative process that produced some of the most influential work of our time. Number 39, We Do What We Do in the Dark, a novel by Michelle Hart. At the heart of this sensual debut novel from former Oprah Daily assistant books editor Hart is a story of yearning between young Mallory and a married college professor. Theirs is a transactional desire on the surface, but Hart delves into the motivations of both Mallory and the professor, referred to in the text only as the woman, to reveal important truths about what our closest relationships say about us and what they help us conceal. Number 40, Glory, by Noviolet Bulawayo. The Booker Prize shortlisted author of We Need New Names returns with a novel inspired by the fall of Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe in 2017. Described as an anthropomorphic allegory in the tradition of Animal Farm, Bulawayo's tale of dictatorship and oppression explores the exaltation and downfall of a would-be savior. Number 41, Mouth to Mouth by Antoine Wilson. A novelist whose flight to Berlin from L.A. is endlessly delayed encounters a former college acquaintance. Their chance encounter begins a tale of psychological suspense in which neither of the characters can be counted on for the truth. It's a slow burn a la Patricia Highsmith that keeps us terminally off balance. Number 42, Sea of Tranquility, a novel by Emily St. John Mandel. The lauded author of Station 11 and The Glass Hotel is back with a novel that, according to her editor, blends historical fiction, science fiction, and autofiction to capture the moment we are living through with devastating emotional precision. If Station 11, now an HBO Max series, anticipated the pandemic, her latest inhabits and expands on it through time travel and an author from a moon colony visiting planet Earth while on book tour. Number 43, Nightcrawling, a novel by Leela Motley. This electrifying debut was written by Motley when she was just 17, and it marks the introduction of a remarkable new talent. Its heroine, Kiera, is attempting to navigate the world of East Oakland, where she and brother Marcus live without parents in a squalid apartment they can no longer afford to pay for. What unfolds is a riveting tale of survival and resilience that is all the more extraordinary for its author's youth. Number 44, The Latecomer, a novel by Jean Hamp Corlitz. The New York Times bestselling author of The Plot, whose 2014 novel You Should Have Known was turned into the HBO series The Undoing, returns with a novel about a rich New York City family whose lives are upended when the parents decide to have a fourth child, when their triplets are 18. If you thrive on tales of dysfunction and privilege told with humor and tenderness, and let's face it, who doesn't? It'll be tough to wait until May, the publication month for this eagerly awaited novel. Number 45, Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Make Us Whole, by Susan Cain. By the author of the 2012 phenom Quiet, this timely and timeless exploration of the melancholic direction of how the tragedy of life is linked inescapably with its splendor is both an antidote for our uncertain times and a toolbox for using angst and yearning as a means of transforming pain into creativity, transcendence, and love. Number 46, In Love, A Memoir of Love and Loss, by Amy Bloom. Bloom's gorgeous, gripping memoir is an ode to her husband, Brian, whose early-onset Alzheimer's diagnosis exploded their world. Bloom is one of our most accomplished fiction writers, but here she chronicles the couple's real-life journey, which ends in Switzerland with Brian's decision to end his life, with his wife's support. But what endures are Bloom's clear-eyed memories of the man she loved, told with tenderness, intimacy, and courage. Number 47, The Family Chow, a novel, by Lan Samantha Chang. Chang's suspenseful and at times hilarious reimagining of the brothers Karamazov centers on a Chinese-American restaurateur in Wisconsin whose suspicious death provokes more than a little domestic drama. Chang also directs the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and her fiction chops are on full display here in this literary mystery that is also a compelling immigrant family saga. Number 48, Burning Questions, Essays and Occasional Pieces, 2004 to 2021, by Margaret Atwood. Atwood has long been considered one of the world's great novelists and a prescient social critic whose writing and activism on vital issues such as the threat to women's rights and the climate crisis have led many to conclude she is a soothsayer. These essays confirm that status. Her collected pieces spanning nearly two decades burn with intelligence, passion, and humanity. Number 49, Anthem, a novel, by Noah Hawley. Five Midwestern teenagers die by suicide, and their deaths set off an epidemic of similar deaths globally. This terrifying, expertly crafted literary thriller by the author of Before the Fall feels especially timely as COVID-induced loneliness is thought to figure into why so many have decided to take their own lives. Number 50, Violetta, English edition, by Isabel Allende. The heroine of Allende's exotic epistolatory tale is looking back on her epic life from age 100, having survived the Spanish flu, the Great Depression, a daughter's death, and much else. Now she is narrating that expansive existence for her grandson from her deathbed. Epic, escapist, and altogether enthralling. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is, I've stopped comparing my Kindle to my books. I thought I'd never go tech. When I was a toddler, I loved sitting in my mom's lap as she read me copies of Dancing in the Wings and Where the Wild Things Are. My trips to the library were regular. Yes, I still owe a substantial late fee. And I'd often get in trouble for keeping my bedroom light on until 4 a.m., completely lost in the pages of a young adult novel. As a teen, I snuck around a borrowed copy of 50 Shades of Grey, one that's still hiding underneath my childhood mattress. Books became a comforting constant in my life. I loved the smell and the feel of crisply bound pages. Hours-long visits to Barnes & Noble were pure bliss, and I realized I wasn't alone. According to the Pew Research Center, old-fashioned print books are still more popular than e-readers. In fact, 67% of Americans have read a paperback in the past year, and 39% of people only opt for print. Contrastingly, 29% of readers use both formats, and only 7% exclusively consume books digitally. Now that I'm older, I'm in that minority. In high school, I discovered that Harry Potter fan fiction was a thing, and quickly began absorbing it on my Android. The fact that I could easily access my favorite fictional hero with the touch of a button suddenly made digital reading not so bad. Meanwhile, I noticed that my aunt, a fellow book lover, had fallen victim to a Kindle. She loved it and enjoyed having thousands of stories at her fingertips. I was intrigued. And then for Christmas 2016, my aunt bought me my first Kindle, the best gift I've ever received. I haven't been the same since. Regular books were always there for me, but once I finished one title, who knew when I'd get to start the next? My Kindle, however, makes the process of hunting for a book thrilling. On command, it allows me to navigate a curated list of thousands of authors and genres, making the journey feel endless. Plus, it's bigger than my smartphone, on which I'd have to squint to view the tiny text. My Kindle Fire comes with me on road trips, to the bathroom, to lunch, and on rare excursions to the gym. It has a special place in my bed, tucked under my pillow every night. I'm mesmerized by this 7.5 by 4.7 inch screen, and let me tell you, the world of 99-cent smutty ebooks is a dark, dangerous, and addicting place. Yet, as I was looking at my bookcase recently, I noticed it hasn't changed much since my high school days. Even though I've read 66 novels in the past 2 years, the average American reads 12 books in one, only 4 were print. This alarmed me. As someone who used to willingly spend hours flipping through pages at a bookstore, I wondered, have I betrayed bibliophiles everywhere? Should I sacrifice it all and chuck my Kindle? To answer these burning questions, I consulted some experts to assess the factors that contribute to the ultimate showdown, e-readers versus real books. But unlike a proper bookworm, I'll go ahead and ruin the ending for you. There's no real winner here. E-readers change the way you retain information. According to Marianne Wolf, director of UCLA's Center for Dyslexia, Diverse Learners, and Social Justice, and the author of Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in the Digital World, text in print slows your mind down, allowing time for critical thinking processes that cultivate empathy and perspective. Basically, these factors allow you to absorb details, a useful benefit for academics. When it comes to reading digitally, the opposite occurs since you do so at a faster speed, which Wolf says provokes multitasking and skimming. This could come in handy if you're perusing emails, however, too much e-reader time can slightly affect whether or not you'll remember those crucial plot details. Admittedly, I found myself swiping back several pages to reread passages. It's not that e-readers are bad for you. Nuggets read via paperback just stay in your mind longer. Because of this, it's important to take a break from the screen. Wolf's tip? Stow away your laptop, phone, and other electronic devices before bed and read a paper book instead. But both types of books affect your eye health. American Optometric Association President Samuel Pierce, OD, says that neither e-readers or paperbacks are better for your vision. However, it's important to acknowledge the drawbacks of each. Not being able to adjust the font size in a print book can lead to eye strain, which causes headaches, dry eyes, and general discomfort. That's not to say that electronic devices can't do the same, but being able to zoom in or out is beneficial if, like me, you don't have 20/20 vision. Pierce adds that after many years, digital devices expose us to blue light, a relatively new phenomenon that's been linked to skin cancer and macular degeneration, an eye disease that causes severe vision loss with aging. In addition, a 2015 study found that the light emitted from screens can make falling asleep more difficult. While this may sound frightening, Pierce says this is no reason to axe your electronics as long as you take precautions. He suggests following the 20/20/20 rule, which is when you stare at something 20 feet away from your screen for 20 seconds after 20 minutes of FaceTime. You can also take advantage of devices with blue light filters or lenses that reduce it. Plot twist, people also now read on their phones. According to a 2016 report by the Pew Research Center, the 28% of Americans who read electronically are actually more likely to do so on a smartphone or tablet as opposed to a Kindle, Nook, or Kobo. This is a reflection of e-reader shipments, which dropped by 16 million units from 2011 to 2016. Let's talk money. One of the reasons I love my e-reader is because there are so many $1 books to choose from. But according to Jonathan Stolper, Senior Vice President of Nielsen Book Americas, ebook sales have decreased because of how expensive individual titles are. As he suggested last year, the average price of a digital book increased by $3 to $8 after the Big Five publishers, Hachette, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Penguin Random House, and Simon & Schuster, gained the ability to set their own prices in 2015. What's confusing is that the New York Times bestsellers list contradicts Stolper's findings. The paper version of James Patterson's Juror No. 3, for instance, is 60 cents cheaper than the digital one, while Clive Cussler's Shadow Tyrants cost $6 more in paperback. Meanwhile, Kevin Kwan's Crazy Rich Asians is 39 cents more expensive on a Kindle, and Dean Koontz's The Forbidden Door is $34.65 in paperback, $16.80 in hardcover, and $14.99 on a Kindle. So what's the answer to the big money question? It's up to you. You can pay $99 to invest in a Nook and then shop for ebooks that vary in price, or you can go to bookstore and do the same. Another option is to head to the local library, which will cost you next to nothing. And what about practicality? Ask yourself this. Would you rather tote one 400-page book in your carry-on or access it via one-pound device? A 2017 Statista survey found that 27% of people out of over 1,000 participants find ebooks more convenient. As someone who looks at my Kindle as a portable bookstore, I can get behind that sentiment. This preference is also reflected in bookstore sales, which saw a 3.6% drop in 2017 compared to the previous year, a puzzling statistic considering other studies say that Americans prefer to read paperbacks. With this in mind, I reached a decision. Determining whether e-readers are better than real books isn't so black and white. Yes, an e-book is easier to carry around, yet preferences for paperbacks remain strong. In the end, the decision is up to the person behind the book. It's your choice if you prefer to squint to read tiny printed text, or zoom in electronically, tap to finish a chapter quickly, or dog-ear pages to really let the story sink in. Me? I'm choosing not to get rid of my Kindle. I was worried that somehow my switch to a screen diminished my love for literature, but if anything, it's intensified it. I haven't stopped reading, I'm just doing it differently and much, much faster. What I will do is make an effort to not solely read on a device. I'm already attached to a screen for 8 hours at work, not to mention the hours I spend watching TV or texting. To me, reading is a way to take a break, so why wouldn't I make use of a tech-free alternative? As Wolf suggested, rekindling, no pun intended, my relationship with paperbacks will only help. I'll be able to slow down, take a deep breath, and escape, because that's why I fell in love with books in the first place. Our next article by Nicole Perkins is titled, How Janet Jackson's All-Black Control Outfit Changed the Way I Saw My Body. Excerpted from the book, Sometimes I Trip on How Happy We Could Be by Nicole Perkins. My parents like to send messages to each other via song. The entire song didn't necessarily have to apply to whatever situation was going on in their marriage. The chorus was the most important part, even just a line or two. My father would come home after being God knows where when he should have been at work, and my mother would cue up It's Over Now by Luther Vandross. It was a song about someone suspicious that his lover was cheating. The chorus went, You did me bad, it's over now. You treated me so bad, it's over now. I don't know if my mother really thought he was cheating. I just think she wanted to let him know she knew he had not been doing what he should have, and she was over it. Depending on my father's mood, he'd give as good as he got, usually with Rick James' Cold-Blooded. The song was about how sexy Rick's lover was and how he hoped she'd return his attention, but my father focused on that repeated chorus of, she's cold-blooded. He wanted to call her cold because she couldn't tolerate the way he'd neglect his responsibilities. I got to hear a lot of good music because of my parents' coded fighting. In 1986, Janet Jackson's album Control began to take the world by storm, and the eponymous single rocked my home. My mother's passive-aggressive game skyrocketed. Janet was 20 and ready to establish herself as more than Michael's little sister. She wanted to show the world her independence, talent, and maturity. My mother was 32. She'd never lived alone. A teenage mother, she went from her childhood home, following the rules of the grandmother who raised her, into what would become an abusive marriage, and she'd never had a chance to establish her own identity. Although Janet was much younger with a vastly different childhood, I think my mother connected to Janet's journey of finding and asserting herself. And Mama was losing patience with my father, his addictions, his abuse, his irresponsibility. She had been working as a nurse at the same clinic since before I was born. In every corner of her life, she was taking care of someone. Her patients, her children, and her trifling-ass husband. Mama was tired and ready to gain control over her life. enter Janet Jackson's third album and its lead single. If my mother started playing Control, it was for a few reasons. Number one, it annoyed my father. Number two, she was giving herself a musical pep talk. Number three, she was letting my father know that for all his abusive bluster, she was the decision maker in the household. And number four, the album was banging and no one could deny that. When Control came out, MTV and BET played music videos around the clock. Janet released a video with every single. She danced her heart out, creating choreography that's been passed all the way down to the TikTok generation. In most of the videos from this album, Janet wears all black attire. I was 8 years old at the time and didn't think much about it until I overheard someone say that black was slimming and that Janet was trying to hide her chubbiness. I don't know when my body image issues began, but they feel as part of me as my moles. When I was a little girl, I was so skinny and small, people always thought I was younger than I was. As a tween, my worst fear was that someone would say I look like a boy. All those fast-developing friends magnified my lack of curves. I'd stand in front of the mirror wondering when my hips and breasts would arrive. My mother laughed at me and told me I wouldn't want them when I got them, but I was impatient and envious. A late bloomer, I envied Janet's all-black uniform and how it was supposed to hide her shape from the world. I wanted that. I needed to hide. I didn't have the shape a black girl was supposed to have, so I wanted to make myself invisible. Wearing fashionable, pretty clothes with bright colors and interesting patterns got compliments, but it also had people looking at your body. I didn't want to bring any more attention to my lack of breasts or whatever else I thought was the marker of moving into womanhood. So when junior high hit and my parents finally divorced, about 3 years after Control came out, I started adding more and more black clothing to my wardrobe. Mama hated it. She loved to stand out with animal prints and colorful earrings. She wore slips with denim skirts. She dressed in a way that let everyone know she was both woman and lady. My sister was her girly girl, but I hated the pinks and flower prints my mom tried to dress me in. I wanted plain t-shirts and black jeans and black sweatshirts and black dresses. All I could think about was black as slimming, so if I had nothing to begin with, maybe in all black I could totally disappear. As my parents' relationship withered, Janet's career as an independent woman and artist grew. Her waistline shrank. Her clothes became more colorful and covered less flesh. My body changed too. I got hips and a little bit of boobs and a healthy portion of ass, but I still wanted to hide. The ass brought too much attention. I understood why. It was the perfect shape to welcome faces. It still is. There's just a bit more of it now. Guys I dated wanted me to show off, but not too much. I remember my college boyfriend and me leaving a friend's house where 10 or so dudes were making music, read, smoking weed, and playing video games. And he scanned the room to make sure no one was watching my ass and the tank dress I was wearing. I can't front. It had a really nice jiggle back then. The thing is, I gained the college freshman 15 and then the sophomore 10 and the junior 10. My curves filled out and I had the perfect Southern woman silhouette. And still, I wanted to hide. Yes, I'd been waiting for my Coke bottle shape since I was 8 years old, but I was supposed to have a flat belly and overflowing breasts, too. Instead, the curves came with a little belly that I had to suck in and breasts that were still small, but perky as hell. My mother would look at me in my new filled-out shape and become emotional. "You're such a woman now," she'd say before commenting on my big legs. Then she'd launch into a series of memories about how little I used to be. I'd been getting harassed on the street since I was 7 years old, so I learned very early on that men will say anything to see how far they can go, that a compliment becomes a threat as soon as you ignore a man. Now, men watched me with even more attention. Everyone had such different reactions to my changing, late-blooming body that I kept pulling out my Janet Jackson uniform, kept trying to disappear again into the mystery of all black. When I was 25, I finally fell in love with my body. I was working out semi-regularly. I was exploring casual sex and not worrying about whether men found me marriable. I loved the power I felt in my body, and then it betrayed me. My spleen spontaneously ruptured, and I had to have emergency surgeries that left me with IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. The PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome, that had gone undiagnosed since my teenage years began causing me problems like weight gain, increasingly irregular periods, and other digestive issues. The significant scar from my surgery sliced my torso in half from just under my breast to the top of my pubic area. It moved through my belly button, leaving it crooked and no longer a place for a lover's tongue. Instead, it left me self-conscious about my body and my wardrobe again. I could no longer wear the crop tops that highlighted my small waist. I had to be careful about bodycon dresses so they wouldn't show the puffiness of my scar or how one side of my belly had healed weirdly and now sticks out farther than the other in a way that sucking in cannot hide. Whatever color my wardrobe had gained in the brief time I loved my body was pushed to the side to make room for more black. Black is slimming. Make me disappear. Black is slimming. Make me disappear. If you can't see me, you can't see all the ways I'm not perfect. I'm older now and more resigned to accept that whatever shape my body is, that's just its shape. I didn't want to spend so much of my time stressing over my body. I tried for so long to be invisible, but I'm here. It feels like my life is finally starting and I want my life to be bright and colorful. I still wear a lot of black, but I love reds, corals, yellows, blues, and purples. During my mid-30s, I compromised with myself and began wearing gray, accentuating it with bright colors. Shortly after my 40s began, I joined a clothes styling service at a department store, and every 2 to 3 months, a professional stylist would suggest outfits for me. I asked him to give me colors and patterns. Otherwise, I'd fall back on old habits. I don't know that I'll ever love my body again, but I'm fine with it. My body is a hormonal, shapeless mess, but it's keeping me alive, and this pussy still yanks, so I'm good. Janet Jackson's Control helped empower my mother to eventually break free from a disastrous marriage. Someone's gossipy throwaway comment about Janet's weight and shape sent me on a 30-year mission of hide-and-seek with my body. That's not Janet's fault. I latched onto this comment to gain control over how my body was viewed, but it never really worked. Everyone saw what they wanted to see, even myself. Our next article by the editors is titled, How to Improve Communication in All Kinds of Relationships, According to Experts. Want to bicker less with your partner? Or perhaps you need pointers on navigating tricky conversations with family or coworkers? We've gathered experts in everything from politics to prose to solve your most pressing communication conundrums. Now for the good news. Forging better bonds is not as complicated as you might think. Sometimes it's even as simple as a well-timed joke. Read their responses to a few pressing questions. My partner and I are at each other's throats more than ever. What can we do to break out of this cycle? Husband and wife team Peter Pearson, PhD, and Ellen Bader, PhD, co-founded the Couples Institute in Menlo Park, California. Pearson. When I see couples who have been together 20 years without a cross word, I think, can this marriage be saved? The people who grow in relationships are willing to test each other. Bader. When you learn how to repair your partner's hurt feelings, to give when it isn't convenient, that's when you're building the emotional muscle you need for a truly intimate partnership. Pearson. You have to ask each other questions and listen to the answers without personalizing too quickly. Not, why are you doing this to me, but let me understand why you believe this or want that. Bader. One of my favorite lines is, can you be curious instead of furious? Pretend you're a reporter doing an interview. Pearson. Ask your partner, what does this really mean for you? Relationship conflicts can trigger painful memories from the past of rejection or abandonment, and that's when a person gives you a 50-cent response to a 10-cent stimulus. If you're really stuck, there are three words that might be more important than I love you. Maybe you're right. Is there a way to offer helpful criticism without sounding like a harpy? Shore up goodwill. Your positive comments should outnumber the negative ones by a healthy margin. Don't expect people to value your criticism unless you first surrounded them with love and respect. Strike while the iron is cold. All criticism should be offered with kindness, not anger. Ask for a specific behavioral change. Your loved one is less likely to respond defensively if you say, please call me when you're going to be more than 15 minutes late, instead of, I can't rely on you. Keep it short and don't exaggerate. Stick to 3 sentences or fewer and don't tell the person they've done something a million times when it's really 3 occasions. They'll only want to correct your distortion and won't hear anything else you say. advice from psychologist Harriet Lerner, PhD, author of Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts. How can I defend my beliefs without losing my cool? When I became a political commentator, I looked for a refresher course in persuasion. Unfortunately, thank you for arguing what Aristotle, Lincoln, and Homer Simpson can teach us about the art of persuasion by Jane Heinrichs had not yet been published, though I highly recommend it. I did stumble across that Monty Python argument sketch. This isn't an argument. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Yes, it is. Which sounds a lot like our current political discourse. I approach every argument as if I'm trying to get out of a speeding ticket, with humor and respect. I listen. And when things get tense, I pretend I'm in a restaurant debating what to order. Public policy isn't coleslaw versus French fries, but persuasion starts with respecting that there are many valid choices. Another trick? Slow down. Powerful speech can come in at around 120 words per minute. Angry or nervous speech can be about twice that. When all else fails, make a joke. There's no better tool for reaching across the aisle. Yes, I just said that, a little pun. Even a bad one goes a long way. Advice from Donna Brazile, a veteran political strategist and former interim national chair of the Democratic National Committee. What can I do to get my family to talk to each other? There are actually several simple changes you can make around your house to encourage conversation. Try dim lighting, which can make people feel relaxed and safe, so they may open up more. Circle sofas or chairs so everyone is facing one another instead of side by side. And make sure the chairs are cushioned. One study found that people are more accommodating when they sit on cushioned surfaces. My wife and I will have difficult conversations on the sofa and family meetings at the breakfast table, which has padded seats. Advice from Bruce Feiler, author of The Secrets of Happy Families. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.